Starting your own private medical practice can be the most exciting and rewarding thing you'll ever do in your career, but at the same time, it can be so daunting. Where do you start and how? That's why Gentem Health put together the podcast series, Journey to Private Practice, where we document and interview entrepreneurs, clinicians, investors, and the best in the industry to bring you actionable insights as how to start, grow, and scale your private practice. With insights tailored just for you, and actionable links in the notes, this is the Journey to Private Practice. Hey, private practice owners, this is Omar M. Khatib, your host for Journey to Private Practice. With a special request, many of you love our Private Practice Growth Series webinars and have requested to have the audio on podcast. And I said, why didn't I think about that myself? So here's the first installment of that. If you're interested in watching the actual webinar so you can see the slides, get access to more resources, just go to gentem.com/webinars and you can see all the webinars we've done. Now, the webinar you're about to listen to is done with one of our newer partners, a very good and dear friend of ours, Dr. Brent Lacey, founder of The Scope of Practice. Now, The Scope of Practice was a blog and podcast that was launched very recently in 2019, actually, where Dr. Lacey, who is a practicing gastroenterologist, focused on delivering the best knowledge and resources to physicians, much like yourself, about business, mastering personal finances, leadership, how to run and scale private practice, all that and more. And in a very short time, in 2021, was listed as the top 30 medical podcasts to listen to. Now, think about how many thousands of medical podcasts there are and how long they've been around for. And Dr. Lacey's Scope of Practice broke into that prestigious top 30 list, and since then has been delivering extremely high value content. This is actually how we got to know each other. So his webinar today is about smart strategies for building a successful clinical practice. Now, coming out of the pandemic, it's so important for every private practice owner to know not only of the best strategies, but what are the smart strategies, right? What are the ones that are actually going to move the needle? So Dr. Lacey goes through key aspects of optimizing a clinical practice for success, where your strategy should be focused, and maybe more importantly, where it should not be focused, plus how to evaluate and manage your most important resources. This is not a surface treatment webinar. This is a very in-depth, high-value webinar that I know you're going to love. If you're interested in seeing the webinar so you can check out the slides, just head over to gentem.com/webinars. Check there. Plus, I have a special offer for you. That's right. Everybody loves offers, and you get one just for listening to this podcast right now. So if you're a private practice owner, you know that uncovering hidden revenue in your claims is really the key to increasing your cash flow and staying independent. Part of that is understanding what do you have to work with. You can't have a good strategy without knowing how you're performing today. Again, as Peter Drucker always said, if you can't measure it, you cannot manage it. And if you can't manage it, you cannot improve it. So head over to gentem.com/SOP, as in scope of practice, and claim your free revenue cycle and billing benchmark assessment. So essentially, our team, being a data-driven company, we will take your current net collections rate, your accounts receivable, and then give you back a report to tell you how you're performing, where you can improve on, right? And more importantly, what strategies make sense for your practice. Whether you become a Gentem customer or not, does not matter. We've done this for hundreds, maybe even thousands of practices at this point. It's a great report and assessment to help you make decisions moving forward. Plus, for a very limited time only, up until June 30th, 2021, if you do this assessment and you decide that Gentem's platform and service makes sense for your private practice, you can get your first month for free with Gentem. That's right, the first month for free of our data-driven platform and our tech-enabled service of certified billers and revenue cycle managers that work hand-in-hand with your team, whether you have a billing team or not. So head over to gentem.com/SOP and claim this free revenue cycle and billing benchmark assessment. Take advantage of it. I know that when my father was in surgical practice, these kind of assessments really helped him make better decisions. I just wish Gentem existed back then. So check out the show notes below for links to all these resources. And now enjoy this webinar of smart strategies for building a successful clinical practice with Dr. Brent Lacey of The Scope of Practice.
What I wanted to talk about today is some smart strategies that people can employ for how to build and grow and sustain a successful clinical practice. So as we're kind of coming out of the COVID pandemic and the shutdown and everything, you know, a lot of practices are still reeling. I know from our standpoint, we had to furlough a pretty substantial number of people last year, and we're about back to fully staffed up with the exception of a couple of departments, but you know, everybody's been hurting. Everybody's been, you know, sort of clawing their way back. And so as you're starting to come out of that, and as you're starting to rebuild and regrow your practice, I think it's really valuable to get a few fundamentals straight so that you can have a really solid foundation. This is kind of a, I guess a particularly relevant, analogy for me. We just finished building a house. And so it took us 7 months before we could finally pour the foundation because we had one of the wettest springs ever last year. And so, you know, but it really drove home the point to me that if you don't have a really, really solid foundation, if you don't get yourself really secure, then your whole house is just going to come crumbling down later. So that's what I'm hoping to build for you here is give you that foundation. We're going to go through a few very broad sort of general principles and then get really practical. So I really want to give you some very specific tips that I think will help you. So this model that I came up with, this concept, I call this the honeycomb of success. And so if you look at a beehive, it's a honeycomb shape. And so it's a series of interlocking hexagons that are all, you know, in this perfect tessellation. And it's very interesting to me. I learned from someone recently, and this just fascinated me, that that structure is actually kind of a cool feat of engineering. And so when people have looked at why do bees build their honeycombs in this particular configuration, as it turns out, from an engineering standpoint, this is the design that allows you to build the strongest physical structure with the minimum amount of material. And so it's not an accident that bees have engineered all of their hives to be these honeycomb structures. Is an incredibly efficient use of resources to build an incredibly strong, highly functioning, thriving unit. And so what I want to do here is help you build the honeycomb with these six parts here that we're going to all surround ourselves with. And there's a lot more that we could talk about, certainly, but I think these six ideas will give you a very basic concept to help you get started. So we're going to first talk about how to get the right practice, how to find and cultivate relationship with the right partners. We're going to talk about getting the right team members in place and how to keep them. We're going to talk about how to grow yourself so that you have you know, some growth that will translate over to your business. We're going to talk about what it looks like to be business-minded, because a lot of physicians just focus on the clinical aspect and nothing else. And that's a fine place to start, but we're going to talk about why there's so much more to it. We're going to talk about a few of the technical aspects, like Omar was talking about a second ago with the business revenue cycle management. And then we're going to talk about some marketing, because you got to be able to tell people that you're there. So let's start with the right practice and the right partners. So if some of you may recognize this image, this is one of my all-time favorite movies. This is from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. This part at the very end here, spoiler alert, in case you haven't seen the movie, Indiana Jones has come to this chamber where the Holy Grail is being kept. And the knight who's guarding it says, you know, there's many cups to choose from. You have to figure out which one's the right grail, but he says, choose wisely, because only the true grail will actually save you. And so that is sort of the theme that I have here for this concept of choosing the right practice and the right partners. Choose wisely. Okay. So choosing the right practice. Now, what does that really look like? Well, if you're coming out of training, then it's going to look very different than if you have been in practice for say 10 or 15 years. If you've been in practice for 10 or 15 years, you're probably not looking to start a new practice or choose a new place to work. And so you may be looking more at cultivating new relationships, changing the way that you work, looking at different ways to practice, things like that. But if you're just coming out of training, or if you're in medical school and you're looking to choose the right practice, there's a few things you need to be aware of. Number one, don't just go to the place that has the best compensation package. Okay. Compensation packages change. And here's the key. If you're a physician, you're going to be fine. Okay. You're going to make enough money. If you live beneath your means and you make smart financial choices in your personal life, you're going to do fine. So don't just go to the place that gives you the biggest signing bonus or the best compensation package or the quickest path to partnership. It needs to not just be about that. There's a lot of factors to choose from. I mean, are you interested in academic medicine versus clinical practice? Do you want to work for a big bureaucratic organization like the VA or Kaiser Permanente or something where it's a big governing body and you're an employed physician? Or do you want to go work in a private practice model where it's more work, but you have more autonomy? You need to really think about all these factors. Where do you want to live? Do you want to live close to family or do you want to really not live close to family? You got to think about those kinds of things. So choosing the right practice becomes very important. You got to factor all those different things in. This is really key here, though, is even more, I think, than choosing the right practice. And this goes part and parcel, but choosing the right partners. Okay. This is just, I can't emphasize enough how important this is. So medical business is really like, you really need to approach it like you approach a marriage. Okay. Now you can propose to somebody after one date, but that's generally not an advisable strategy. There's a lot of ways for that to go wrong. And so you really want to take your time selecting the right people to work with, because the people that you're going to be working with, if you're building a practice, you need to plan on that you're probably going to be building that practice for 30, 40 years. In most cases, people don't tend to move around the country once they sit down and establish a practice in one particular city. You get settled, you grow roots, and that's where you're going to be. So you're going to be working closely with these people for 50, 60, 80, 100 hours a week for decades. So you need to vet them. You need to really know who you're working with. So spend some time getting to know them. If you're going for just an interview weekend, take a few extra days and go see if you can go shadow people in the clinic, see if you can go over to the hospital where they're working, see if you can meet their staff, spend time meeting their patients, go around the community, see the, talk to some of the referring physicians and talk to them. What's their reputation like? Do you like referring to these guys? Do you think that they're a good group to work with? Really spend time picking people that you trust, that have high integrity, that are fun to be around. I can't tell you the number of people who I've talked to have said they just don't like working with, they love medicine. They just don't like the people they work with. And, you just need to choose the right people. The next thing is, once you have that relationship, you need to cultivate really strong, thriving relationships with your partners. And this is going to be important if you're just starting out, but this is at least as important if you've been in practice for a long time. So if you've been in practice for, say, 10 or 15 years, and you feel like you don't really know your partners very well, or you have just sort of a cordial or even a distant relationship, you can function that way, but businesses function so much better when everybody is really well integrated and everybody's friendly and excited to work with each other. And there's chatter and there's talking, there's banter going on and there's practical jokes and things like that. So spend some time really getting to know people on a personal level, go out to lunch with people, go out to a ball game, get to know each other's families, but really take time to learn these people. It's just like when you're, when you're dating or when you're during an engagement, you're getting to know somebody before you finally make a really serious commitment. But really spend that time over the years cultivating those relationships with your partners, okay? Because these are the people that you're going to be working with for a very long time. And then the final thing is choose good leadership. Now, this is a little harder to figure out up front, but I think one of the ways that you can do this is by talking to people who are not in leadership. So you can talk to leaders, and a lot of times you can figure out things just from the way that they talk about how they approach dealing with human resources problems. Or you could ask them, how do you deal with challenging situations with partners? You can ask them some questions, but I really think that you can get a lot of this by just talking to the people that work there. Attitude reflects leadership. And so if you just go hang out in an office that you're interviewing in, just go hang out there for a couple of hours and just listen to how the staff talk to each other. Is there laughter? Is there playful banter going on? Or are people generally smiling? Or are there two people off in the corner and they're kind of whispering, and you can tell there's some gossip going on? Or people are just, people pick up the phone and they're like, yes. And then they kind of roll their eyes, what's the attitude in the office? And so if you've got an attitude, an air of disinterest or apathy or toxicity, you're going to pick up on that if you just kind of pay attention to it. So choose good leaders, because you want someone who's going to really help grow a good and thriving practice for you. Okay. This is one of my favorite leadership maxims. And I think this is really a good segue into our next point in the honeycomb, where we talk about team members. And this concept is that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And so what I mean by that is that you can have the best vision, the best strategic plan, the best overall way of doing things. You got all these great ideas. You got all these you know, 2 and 3 and 6 year plans going on. And then if you don't have a good team, if you don't have good team members that are really motivated and energetic, if you don't have people that are coming up with new ways to make things better, it's all going to fall apart. If you ever read the book, The Art of War by Sun Tzu, one of the maxims that he talks about is that no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. So you can have all these great strategic visions and have it completely fall apart because you just have the wrong team. So if you look at this trophy right here, you may recognize this as the World Series of Baseball trophy. And the thing that strikes me as interesting about a team like the World Series champions in baseball, it's the best team in baseball in that year. I mean, that's what that means, is that they've won the most games. They are the best team. But what it doesn't mean is that they have the best player at every single position. So when the Yankees win the World Series, for example, it doesn't mean they have the best shortstop and the best pitcher and the best catcher and the best right fielder. But they are the best team. They've got good people working together and they're all working in their strengths. And that's what you want to see. So you want to get the right people and you want to get them in the right place. Now, one of the things that I think is really helpful for me is there's a couple of books by a guy named Jim Collins. One is called Good to Great, and the other one is called Built to Last. And if you've never read those books, Jim Collins, if you've never read those books, you got to read those. They are absolutely vital for any business owner or any business leader. But one of the things he talks about is the concept of a business being like a bus. And so in order to get the bus to where you want to go, you want to have the right people on the bus. You want to have the right people in the right seats on the bus, and you want to get the wrong people off the bus. So we're going to break that down here. So let's start with getting the right people on the bus. And that comes down to hiring the right people. This is an area that I find is very challenging for a lot of businesses. Most people don't do hiring very well. It's very normal to have a hiring process that is maybe 2 30-minute interviews or 2 hour-long interviews or something like that. And you get some references and maybe you call the references, but there's not a lot of vetting that goes on. You just, you know, you talk to them for a half hour. Yeah, I kind of like them. Yeah, they've got decent credentials. Their CV looks okay. Let's give it a shot. And sometimes you get lucky on that, and sometimes you can go really, really wrong with that. And so I think it's really valuable to have a hiring strategy that is complex and involved. And a lot of times people will hear me say that and they're like, wait, you want me to take, you know, a couple of months to hire somebody and go through 6 interviews and, you know, take them, you know, do all these different kinds of creative things. And that's a lot of time spent. And it is, it's a lot of time invested up front, but it is a lot better to invest that time up front and get all the right people and not have them turn out to be the wrong person 9 months from now. And then you have to let them go and hire and train someone all over again. One of the most expensive, one of the most time-consuming things that you can do is have high employee turnover. It's just a real problem. And so if you're constantly having this revolving door of people going through where you hire someone and they stay for a year or two, and then they just leave, or you have to let them go because they're just not quite cutting it, you need to overhaul your hiring process, make it more complicated, have more interviews, longer interviews, get creative with it. I've seen people that, you know, they'll interview someone by, you know, just taking them out to a ball game, just kind of, you know, showing them a good time or taking them out shopping or something. And they're just doing it as kind of a quote unquote get to know you thing, but it's very interesting. You get someone out of the interview setting, they kind of let their guard down and they start to show you who they are. And if they're really rude to, you know, the wait staff or the people that are serving you or something like that, that's probably not someone you want to be with. So those are the kinds of things that can be very helpful. The second thing is assigning the right roles. One of the things that you may find is that if you have a team member who's just not quite firing on all cylinders, you know, they seem like they should be really good, but they're just not bringing it every day. They're doing okay, but they're not doing great. You need to think about whether or not you actually have them in the right role. So I remember we had a nurse one time that she's wonderful. She's personable. She's nice. She's skilled. And, you know, the role that we had her in where she was forward facing and doing pre-op stuff, she just really wasn't thriving in that role. And then we moved her to a different role where she's doing pre-op calls and post-op calls and doing all the stuff on the phone every day. And man, she is just blossomed in that role. She is phenomenal. And it's great because it was a role that other people were just trading around and nobody was really fitting it. And she just loves it and thrives in that. And so sometimes it's not about rehabbing the person. It's about figuring out where their strengths are and getting them working in their strengths. The next thing, and this one's tough, this one's one of the hardest ones, is firing people who don't meet your standards. And this is a hard one, I think, for almost any business leader. And so, I mean, if you're a good business leader, if you're a good boss, you lose sleep over this kind of thing. And that's, I think that's a good thing. I really do. But one of the things that I do see a lot of is that people hold on to people that they need to let go of. And they hold on for way, way too long. And this is a real problem. One of the questions that I heard asked on in a leadership book one time that I thought was just incredibly valuable is you can ask yourself this question. If I had to hire for this position today, is this the person I would want in that role? And if your answer is, then you've got the wrong person. Either they're in the wrong, either they're a good person, but they're in the wrong role, or they're not right for your company, one of the two. And so if you want really good team members, you got to get rid of the ones that aren't meeting their standards. Now, I think it's incumbent on you as a leader to show them where they're falling short, give them opportunities to rise to meet your expectations, you know, be very, very clear, be very critical. And then if they're not meeting those standards, let them go, let them find another place to go work. But you got to get the right people on the bus. You got to get the wrong ones off the bus. And then you got to get the right people in the right roles. And then finally, you got to cultivate the right team culture. I think a team culture that is really dynamic and thriving and exciting, and everyone enjoys being together, and everyone's looking to do things right and do things better, That's such a great place to work. And those are the businesses that tend to thrive. And so you want team members that are personable, that enjoy working together, that are just fun people to be around. But one of the big key features that I think is really crucial to find in an ideal team player is someone who is just constantly motivated to do just a little bit better. They wake up thinking, how can I be 5% more efficient? What can I do to make this 5% safer? What can I do to make this, you know, 5% faster? And if you've got a whole team culture where everyone is really geared towards making things just a little bit better all the time, and everybody's trying to do that, you will constantly be in a state of growth and improvement. And it's absolutely phenomenal. So, and that starts from the top. I mean, if you're the leader, you've got to be the one setting the standard for that and encouraging that, incentivizing it, rewarding it when you see it, celebrating it. I mean, that's got to come from the top. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about personal growth. This is another one of my favorite leadership maxims. Healthy things grow, and growing things change. And this is one of the things that is, you know, it tends to rough people up a little bit. You know, you kind of want to settle into a groove, right? You want to do things right. You want to do things well, but you kind of want to get into a comfort zone and get into a routine. But the truth is, if you want to grow your business, you got to grow as a leader. So, this is really true. I think that your company, your business isn't going to grow unless you grow. So as you're thinking about ways to grow your business and ways to improve, and ways to increase your number of patients and your revenue and all that, you've got to be growing yourself. So if you want to grow your business 20% this year, you need to grow as a leader 20% this year. So what does that look like? Well, a few things. So this is a concept I call embracing the 1%. Every clinical specialty has that 1% of the medical specialty that is just really challenging, really frustrating. So for gastroenterology, which I do gastroenterology, it's irritable bowel syndrome. It is a just challenging diagnosis. It's frustrating. You know, we never find anything structurally wrong because there isn't anything structurally wrong. And yet people have very real pain and they're miserable and our therapies aren't that great. And it can be extremely frustrating and tiresome. And it's very easy to get sucked into the trap of feeling like, nah, you know, I love everything else about GI, but I don't have to love, you know, irritable bowel syndrome. And that's true. But what you can't do is you can't hate it. And that's a really important thing. So if you're in med school, if you're in training and you're still thinking about, well, what am I going to do? What am I going to do as far as, you know, my specialty? Let me encourage you, make sure that whatever you do find that you think you want to do, you need to love almost everything and you need to not hate anything. And those aren't the same thing, because I guarantee you that if there's one thing in that specialty that you absolutely hate and you can't stand, it will consume your life. And so for me, knowing that this was a possibility, when I was in training, I chose to train myself to find irritable bowel syndrome fascinating. And it was a challenging thing at first, but over time, it became very, natural for me. And now when I see patients that are coming in with irritable bowel syndrome type complaints, I don't immediately roll my eyes and go, oh, not this again. Because I see a lot of people that do that kind of thing and they're just miserable. And it's very hard to grow when you're living in misery like that. So if you can learn to embrace whatever that sort of dark underbelly is about your specialty, then it will facilitate more growth. Whereas if you choose to let that become a cancer in your soul, it will just drag you down. It's very, very difficult to grow when you've got one little thing just kind of always poking at you and always making you miserable. The second thing that you got to do is read. If you want to be a leader, you've got to be a reader. And so one of the free resources that I'm going to have for you at the end, you can go to this website if you want, is a reading list that has a bunch of books, 35 books that I've curated in this list that will help you grow as a leader, as a business owner, grow with your personal finances. But if you commit to reading a book, say a book a quarter that is related to business, leadership, management, something that personal development, something that will help you get better in some aspect of your life, you will just grow. You can't help but just grow. So if you want to be a leader, you got to be a reader. The next thing that I think is really important, and this is something that a lot of physicians I think don't think about, but lead even when you're not in charge. So one of the things that I hear from folks a lot when I'm coaching people on their career is, they say, well, I'm not the one in charge. I'm not really in charge of making decisions. And what I tell people is you can be a leader wherever you are. You don't have to wait for someone to give you the invitation. Lead where you are. So if you're not a department chair, you're not a, division head, you're just a staff gastroenterologist, you're a staff pediatrician, you're a staff orthopedist, whatever. You have the ability to lead somebody. Okay. So one of the ways that you can do that is go find a problem that needs solving. And trust me, people are more than happy to tell you their problems. It takes about 10 seconds to find a problem that needs to be solved. But talk to your nurses, talk to your MAs, talk to your staff, talk to your bosses. This is one of those things that as you're going forward, it is just so easy to find problems that nobody else wants to tackle. And if you're the gal who can solve that, oh my gosh, not only will the people underneath you that are serving underneath you or that are subordinate to you, not only will they appreciate and respect you, not only will they take you more seriously as a leader, but the people above you start to notice too. And so for me as a leader, if I have someone who wants more authority, they want more responsibility, what I tell them is show me what you can do with the authority and the leadership role that you've been given right now. So because if I can't expect and trust that you're going to do something great with what you've been given, then why would I give you more to manage? So the easiest way to do that is just go ask people, what's a problem that you have that needs solving? Find a way to solve it. That's what leadership is. It's honestly solving problems. And the last thing is develop leaders under you. So one of my teachings that I live by that I've embraced is comes from Cicero. The Latin phrase is translates as we learn by teaching. And I don't think there's a better way to learn than having to teach something to someone in a way that gets them to understand it. It forces you to understand things in a much, much deeper way. And so extending that, if you're developing leaders under you, you have to be developing these leadership and these business growth concepts in yourself. You have to be understanding them. You have to be employing them, or you can't inculcate those values in other people. And so find someone to mentor, find people that you can coach, find people that you can help develop into a better version of themselves. And that will help you grow as a leader as well. All right. So the fourth thing we're going to talk about is paying attention to the business. Now, this is something that is the reason why I started the scope of practice, is because this is an area where physicians a lot of times miss the boat. And I think it's one of the things that has led to the rise in the employed physician model. And if you're in an employed physician status, hey, more power to you. It's totally fine. Nothing wrong with that. But one of the things that I think has happened over the years is that as we are becoming more, as medicine is becoming more complex and more involved and it requires more of our time and there's more administrative requirements and things, we have less time to pay attention to the business side of things. And so you can pick up the business skills. You can learn how to cast vision. You can learn how to set a budget. You can learn how to hire and fire, but it's a whole new skill set to pick up. And so if you spend all of your time doing your medical stuff, then you're not able to spend time paying attention to the business. But I think it's really important. The business has to thrive in order for you to be able to take care of your patients. But you have to get the polarity right. It is absolutely imperative that we remember why we are doing this. So you want to run a great business so that you have the ability to provide excellent medical care to your patients. That's what we do. And that's what you want to do as a physician. It's not the opposite, okay? We're not taking care of patients so that we can have a great business and make a lot of money. But if you don't pay attention to the business, if you don't take care of things on that side, if you say, well, you know, it's kind of icky. I don't like thinking of it in that way. I just want to take care of my patients. That's all fine. But if you don't have a thriving business, it won't be around long enough to be able to provide that excellent care and to be able to take care of your employees and their families. This is an area where I struggled with this for a while, but I read a great book called Profit First by a guy named Mike Michalowicz that I think really helped me. One of the things he talks about is when you are dealing with your revenue, take profit out of the business first, pay yourself first, and then figure out what are all the money's going for all of your expenses. And that sounds kind of weird to a lot of people. They go, okay, that's very selfish. It's very egotistical. No, it's really not. You have to first take care of your family and take care of your business, and then use the rest of the money to provide for everything else. And I'll tell you what, here's something that's very interesting. When you start taking profit first out of the business, and not a ridiculous amount, right? I mean, obviously you take enough that is a reasonable amount for you. But if you start taking profit first out of the business, and then you look and see, okay, how much is left? It changes the way that you think about your expenses. You start looking around and going, okay, I wonder if I have too many people doing the same roles and there's too much duplication of effort. I wonder if there are things that we can automate here because my expenses are way too high. You know, I wonder if we need to, you know, get with a company like Gentem and figure out how to do revenue cycle management because our accounts receivables are 127 days. You know, it forces you to start making some difficult choices and start really thinking about where your expenses are coming from. And so flipping that model on its head where you take profit first and then, to start distributing, I think really is helpful. That's a great book you should read called Profit First by Mike Michalowicz. The third thing is hire out the things that you can't do. So going back to the World Series analogy, the guy who's the pitcher on the World Series champion team isn't also trying to be the third base coach, right? They're not also trying to be the right fielder. They're not also trying to be the bat boy. So there's going to be certain things that you are incredibly skilled at and certain things that, you know, you're really not skilled at, and that's okay. And so if you've got something that's an important role to fill and you don't know how to do it really well, hire it done. So get an office manager to help you run the day-to-day operations of the clinic. If you're not really good at managing people, if you're really not great with money, get a CFO, get an accountant, get a CPA, get someone to work with you. So find people who are experts in the things that you don't have expertise or high levels of proficiency in and hire that to be done. So you don't have to do everything all by yourself.
Hey, podcast listeners, I wanted to share a story with you. Now, believe it or not, my father was a private practice owner just like you. He had his own general surgery practice for 35 years and spent the last 10 doing varicose veins and other vascular procedures in his office. He loved private practice because he was in control of how he practiced medicine. But even back then, billing was an issue. Now, despite that, my father was lucky to choose when he wanted to retire, and he did so with his independence as a clinician and a practice owner. But not everyone is lucky like that these days. That's because getting reimbursed is even more complicated than ever. Practicing medicine today comes with more headaches and more responsibilities. So along with the complexities and demand of caring for your patients, your mind is also occupied with all these headaches that come with running a private practice, like submitting claims and managing your accounts receivables, dealing with insurance companies and denials. All of that just to get reimbursed in time and in full. And more often than not, that doesn't happen that way. And this can be such a tough task and extremely frustrating, but it does not have to be like that anymore. To adapt in a world with an ever-changing environment, especially in healthcare, means to seize opportunities when you see them. And that opportunity is to use data-driven technologies. That's why I need a trusted partner like Gentem. Gentem is a Silicon Valley-based company founded by a Stanford-educated physician and a former Facebook software engineer. And they found that uncovering hidden revenue in your claims is the key to increasing your cash flow and staying independent. It's only possible through what's called predictive reimbursement modeling, and that's on Gentem's platform. Why is that important? Because then you're using the power of data to see how well your practice is doing, how to maximize reimbursements, decrease the time it takes for you to get reimbursed. More importantly, as payers get more creative with denials, you are able to use the data to adapt and stay ahead. And not only that, but you also get the support of Gentem's remarkable team of medical practice experts with decades of experience in healthcare. They're an extension of your practice in that they work with all departments to achieve optimal revenue with dedicated resources, including certified billers, coders, and revenue cycle managers, all working and paying attention to the data specific to your region and your specialty. Gentem also develops products specifically made for private medical practices. So when your practice is ready to invest in hiring more staff, perhaps new technology, or even acquiring a facility or building one out yourself, don't go and fill out a long, complicated application at the bank and get handcuffed to a high-interest bank loan. Gentem uses Gentem Advance to essentially advance payments to you based on your outstanding AR. You get the capital that you need today to grow, and then you pay it back based on your future claims. So head over to gentem.com/SOP as in scope of practice to claim your free benchmark assessment where you're going to learn about your high-risk AR, the lost medical billing revenue that you might have and how you can improve it, plus what kind of Gentem products make sense for you. So head over to gentem.com/SOP and get your free benchmark assessment and demo now.
Expertise or high levels of proficiency in and hire that to be done. So you don't have to do everything all by yourself. And then the final thing is encouraging innovation. So this is what I was talking about a few minutes ago, where you have all of your team members are all thinking about how to make things better. So one of the things that we are handicapped by, I think, as physicians, is that we tend to be very motivated, very high achieving, very smart people. And one of the challenges with that is that we oftentimes want to do everything ourselves. But the problem with that is if you spend all of your time trying to come up with brilliant ideas, you can only come up with so many brilliant ideas at a time. If instead you coach everybody else on your team and you encourage and you celebrate innovation and you reward people who are looking for ways to make things more efficient and safer and a better customer experience, then you get to celebrate having the brilliant ideas of everybody on your team. And so instead of being limited to the brilliance of one person, you get to expand and multiply the brilliance of everybody. And so that is really, really important. And so really cultivate that culture where innovation is both incentivized and celebrated and rewarded. All right. So thinking about some of the technical aspects of the business. So this is something that, it can be kind of the bane of people's existence. So for example, the EMRs, oh my gosh, if I had a nickel for every time someone said, I hate this computer system, I would, I'd just retire. I probably, but EMRs are here to stay, right? So we've got to get good at it. The good thing is that a lot of the electronic medical record systems, really all of them, have a variety of different shortcuts and hacks and things that will make you more efficient. So if you find that you're typing the same set of instructions 58 times a week, put that in a simple macro or a dot phrase or a smart text or something like that, that you can just type three keystrokes and then it just appears. Find ways that your EMR can integrate between the front desk and the MAs and you and the nurses and the billing people, so that people aren't having to open up seven different systems to work on everything, separately. They can all have it as one integrated, seamless thing, but learn something about it. Get someone to come out and teach you, to do tutorials. I mean, taking the time up front and investing that time up front to really get this stuff figured out and get proficient at it will pay huge dividends in terms of your time down the line. Billing and coding. I had a podcast episode on this on my podcast probably about 4 months ago, and it kind of blew my mind when I was talking to this physician who has become a coding expert, who was saying that she's worked with folks around the country that just by making simple coding changes, that they're using the wrong modifier on things, or they're using a code that is not being billed properly, they're losing out on upwards of $100,000 a year per per doctor in a like an OBGYN office or something. And not that everything's about money, but my goodness, we run a business and there's no reason to be paid less than what you're actually providing your services for, that, you know, less than you should be valued for. So you got to get really good at this. And it, honestly, I don't think it's enough to just turf this off to a biller and a coder and have like, and have it be outsourced. You got to know enough about it to be able to do it reasonably well, and to be able to ask the right questions, and to be able to recognize when they're doing something wrong, or when they're missing the boat on something. So getting good at billing and coding, this is something I had to get really good at when I came out of the military. So I was in the military for 11 years. And so we didn't really have to think about this too much, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I didn't hardly ever pay attention to it, but when I came out, oh my gosh, I just had this huge whiplash where all of a sudden I was like, okay, I have got to figure this stuff out. Cause I had people come in and say, no, you can't use this code. No, this is going to make the patient not be able to receive, you know, reimbursement for it. You got to pay attention to that stuff. So that becomes very, very important. The next thing is designing and remodeling your physical space. I would challenge you to think about this for a second. When was the last time that you stopped in the middle of your clinic somewhere and just looked around and really looked critically at things? You know, do you have paint that's peeling off the walls, or do you have linoleum tiles that are chipped? Do you have, you know, those drop tiles in the ceiling that are water stained? You know, what does it smell like in your clinic? You know, are there a lot of screaming kids in the waiting room because you don't have any, you know, toys or games or things for them to play with? There's little beads on a wire or something like that, right? So take some time and think about what your clinical space looks like, and get your staff to walk around and just lay critical eyes on things. What's the flow like? You know, is it confusing? You know, do you have doors that are kind of hidden in one place? Is the bathroom not easy to find? Do you have the scale where you weigh patients? Is it in the middle of a walkway where, you know, 29 people can hear, oh, Mrs. Jones, you weigh 178 pounds, right? So think about these kinds of things really critically, so that you have a good place to be. And it's all part of the patient experience. They will remember how it feels walking through your space. They'll remember the smells. They'll remember how loud it was. So pay attention to those kinds of things. And the last thing that I think is really valuable is revenue cycle management. So Omar kind of alluded to this, and, you know, companies like Gensim, I think, are really excellent at helping us identify this. But, you know, if you're in a say a specialty like mine, like GI, or a procedure based specialty, or even if you're not, if you're trying to get a service pre-authorized and you don't do that before the patient goes and gets the service, you may not get reimbursed, or the patient may be stuck paying a huge bill at the end. Well, that's a huge problem, right? And so if you've got patients that keep coming back and they keep not, they keep coming back and seeing you once a week or once a month, and they keep not paying their bills, why are you continuing to see that person? You got to start collecting some of those revenues up front. So it becomes very important to figure out where in that cycle are you not securing that revenue that you have reasonably earned, and really start to recapture that. And so that's where companies like Gensim can be very helpful. But honestly, just going through and seeing, okay, doing something very simple, like talking to your front desk and say, just check this person's bill. If they haven't paid their bill, just tell them they have to pay their bill before they can come back and be seen. I mean, you'd be amazed at how much your revenue will kick up. I've seen revenue cycles that kick up 10, 15, 20% just from that one little move. So that kind of thing can be extremely helpful. And then the final thing we'll talk about is marketing yourself and your practice. So, so Omar was actually on my podcast here not too long ago. We talked about branding and marketing, and I really feel like this is a hugely important thing. I've done a lot of reading on this in the last couple of years as I've been trying to pay more attention to it. And one of the things that I've really come to appreciate is that your reputation as a physician, and as by extension, as a clinical practice, really, really matters. And so what people think of you in the community will really affect how many referrals you get, whether or not, you know, patients, you know, send you their family members, their friends, and that starts to affect your revenue. So there's a few things that you can do that will be really helpful with this. Number one is just be available. Okay. So if you're a physician and you're booked out for 4 months, it doesn't matter how good you are. Okay. If I can't get in to see you, it doesn't really do me very much good. So find yourself, find ways to be available. And if you're booked out 4 months, maybe it's time to hire someone else to come and help you. Maybe it's time to bring on another partner, or maybe there's other ways that you can, you know, kind of bridge that gap. You know, you can train your staff how to triage some things, and they can, you know, have the nurses make some calls for you. You can do things over telehealth, and you can do shorter visits. Maybe you can do some things by email. Maybe there's some other things that you can do. But find ways to make yourselves available to your patients. That's the number one thing that is driving customers, especially young customers now, is they want, it's sort of the self-service generation, right? People want, they want their service now, and they want it quickly. And that's just sort of the way things are. That is the general expectation, but be available. And the second thing is just be really good. I mean, that's obvious, right? But you know, the thing is, patients take it for granted. They just assume that because we have an MD and we have a diploma on the wall, that we know what we're talking about. But I'll tell you what, other physicians and patients, they can tell the difference between a good physician and a really good physician. And so be really excellent at your craft. And take pride in that. And patients will notice, and that will really translate into serious referrals. The second thing is serve referring physicians well. Now, even if you're in a primary care setting, serve other physicians well. So as a gastroenterologist, I get lots and lots of referrals from community family practice docs and internal medicine docs and pediatricians. And one of the things that I try to do is anytime that I've got a patient that has a really bad result, like they have a cancer or they have something really complicated, or it's just a really confusing case, or if it's just something interesting, I'll make a personal phone call to their physician. And I'll tell you what, physicians really appreciate knowing what's going on. Like, oh man, I was worried Miss Jones might have cancer. Thank you so much for calling me. And that extra little personal touch, that goes a long, long way. Or if you have a way that you can solve a problem for that physician, you know, if I've got a patient that they've been dealing with for a while, they've got horrible abdominal pain, and I go in and I spend an hour talking to them about their irritable bowel syndrome and coach them and work with them, and then that person's not on that physician's phone sheet anymore 3 times a week, that will really endear you to that person. And it cuts both ways. So when I get referrals from really excellent primary care docs that I can read their notes and I read their consults and I see, man, this guy, this gal, they really know something. They're really quality. I have referred people to them. People that are coming in, they've just moved to a new area. They say, oh, you know, my mom's coming into town and she's moving here and she wants a family practice doc. I'm like, you know, I've got a great person for you. So that can be very, very helpful for you. The next thing that you can do, this is a very, very simple exercise. And if you download the free tool that I'm going to give you here in a few minutes, then you can have a guide that'll walk you through how to do this. But have a good one-liner. You may have heard this referred to as an elevator pitch. So what this is, it's a 1, 2, 3 sentence thing that will say what you do, what problem you solve, and how people benefit from it. So for example, my one-liner for the scope of practice is as follows. Most physicians and dentists come out of training with a really great understanding of medicine or dentistry and very little idea of how to actually run a clinical practice or how to manage their personal finances. So I started the scope of practice to be the place where you can get the knowledge, the resources, and the tools that you need to manage your business more successfully and master your personal finances so you can have the career and the life that you deserve. Okay. Now that's a very, very compact, simple way to say who you are and what you do. And so having that be, and so if you have something very specific like that, you know, if you're an orthopedist, you say, you know, most people suffer needlessly through joint pains their whole life, but we put people first and work to find solutions that are minimally invasive that will enhance your ability to be pain-free and have the kind of activities that you want to do. That's a lot more engaging to someone who asks what you do than to say, oh, I'm a doctor. Right. So it opens up that storyline and all of a sudden they're like, oh, interesting. So, you know, I've been having a lot of joint pain now that you mention it. So tell me more about what you do. So that can be a very, very simple thing that you can do. And then the last thing with that is have a good website with content. 88%, this blew my mind. I learned this recently. 88% of patients find their doctor online before they ever come see their doctor. And some of that is actually finding the doctor, and some of that is just researching and learning more about the doctor. And so I can't tell you the number of people that have come into my office and said, oh, you know, I read that you were in the Navy. You know, my father was in the Navy, or I understand that you're really active in your church. You know, what church do you go to? And so we talk about all these things, and it really helps to set me up for success because it gives me it gives me something to talk about. But if you've got a great website with good content, if people in your neighborhood, in your community are saying, you know, my leg hurts, and they just search that, my leg hurts, and then your website comes up with, does your leg hurt? Here's some things that, you know, may be going on. Here's some ways that you can help fix it. And here's when to know when you need to come see a physician, man. Then all of a sudden they're like, okay, I understand this. That makes some sense. And there's, they go to you as your resource. And then when it's time for them to see a physician, they're like, you know what, where did I find that one article? I'm going to go see that guy. He obviously knows what he's talking about. So just reviewing real quick, this is what I call the honeycomb of success. So with you at the center, you're getting the right practice, you're choosing the right partners, you're cultivating those really strong relationships with your partners, you're hiring the right team members, you're getting them in the right roles, and you're getting rid of the wrong people. You're growing as a leader, you're reading, you're becoming more business-minded, you're allowing yourself to continue to treat your patients really well, take good, excellent medical care, but focus also on the business aspect of things. You're dealing with those technical aspects of the EMR and the revenue cycle management and things like that, so that your business doesn't suffer needlessly because you're just not paying attention to those things. And then finally, you're marketing yourself. You know, you're cultivating a reputation for availability, for excellence, and for high quality service and customer experience. I mean, you do these things and you will be successful. I mean, it's just a matter of time. These things really, really work. And so we'll do the Q&A here in a second, but if you're interested, this is a free resource that I put together for people that you're welcome to download for free. It's got some guides for how to recognize and celebrate your team members, creating a personal mission statement or mission statement for your company, creating that one-liner we talked about a second ago to help you grow your business, the reading list that I mentioned, and then a 10-day challenge to help you make over your clinic. Just 10 simple things that you can do, one each day, that will make you just a little bit better. And so you can also email me here, editor@thescopeofpractice.com, or check out the website. I got a lot of great content and would love to help you and continue the conversation. So with that, I will turn it back over to Omar for our Q&A.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Lacey. Can you hear and see me?
Let's see. Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Great. Well, amazing. And I want to be mindful of your time. And so let's get straight into the Q&A. We're probably going to go a little bit over. Do you have a hard stop in a few minutes, or can you go?
I definitely don't. I am here for the stay.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Great. Well, yeah. And again, for those who are listening, you can either raise your hand, you can come on live to ask a question, or just submit a question and I can read it out. So I see some people who submitted. Dr. Juan, I also is raising your hands. We have two. All right, we're going to get to you right now. But let's kick off with one question, Dr. Lacey. You know, what I love about what you presented is that it's not a quick fix things, but these are the things that are transformative to our business. Something I feel that every physician, you know, or practice manager can do this week is implement efficient time hacks. What are some like two or three efficient productivity time hacks you can implement like tomorrow that'll make a difference?
So a couple of things. One is batching. I find that batching is very helpful. So one of the things that happens very often is that you run from thing to thing. It's crisis to crisis. You go see a patient, someone grabs you and says, oh, I need you to call this patient back. And then someone else grabs you, oh, there's this email. And then you go see this next patient. And then you realize, oh, wait a second, I was supposed to, respond to someone's text that they sent me. There's a lot of start and stop. There's a lot of lead time and lag time that happens. And so, if you can say, okay, you know, just train your team and say, okay, from 3:30 to 4:30, that's going to be phone message time. So if there's something that's not urgent that a patient needs, that's medication refills or whatever, I'm going to take that hour. So hold all my phone messages until then. We're going to take care of them all at once. Or, you know, over, you know, 11:30 to 12 o'clock is going to be emails. And I'm going to spend 30 minutes and answer my emails. I'm not even going to look at emails between now and then. I'm going to focus only on this one task. So focus on one task at a time, and then just cluster everything instead of going from thing to thing. The second thing that I think is really valuable is find ways to coach your team to bring you near ready issues. And what I mean by that is that, well, I'll give you a concrete example. So I had a team member that was sending me tasks that would say something to the effect of patient needs a med refill. And that's all it says. And then I'm going through and looking at the chart and going, okay, now what was she needing? Okay, that's right. She's probably running out of her Prilosec. Okay, what was her dose again? Okay, when did she refill it? Okay, wait, was it once a day or twice a day? And I'm spending 10 minutes on this thing. And so what I coached my team is said, okay, when you get something like that, it needs to say something like this. Mrs. Jones is needing a refill of this medication at this dose with this frequency. She last refilled it at this time. She says she's doing really well. No symptoms. She doesn't need to change her medication. Great. That's a ready-made thing. If they actually bring me a hand script or they send me a, you know, an electronic thing and I just sign it. I mean, that takes me 20 seconds as opposed to 10 minutes. That is an immediate improvement in the amount of time. So if you can find little things like that, that you're spending 3 and 5 minutes on at a time, and you can reduce those to a minute or less, that will multiply huge over time.
Fantastic. Thank you. So Dr. Lacy, I'm going to bring on Dr. Ruan, who's also, I believe, also in Texas. Dr. Ruan, I'm bringing you on. So ask your question now and go ahead and unmute yourself as well.
Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Hey, Dr. Ruan, good to hear from you. Go ahead and ask your question of Dr. Lacy. And we got three Texans on this, so this is special.
Hey, Dr. Lacy. I'm in Houston, Texas. I'm the founder and CEO of Texas Center for Lifestyle Medicine. So private practice group, I've been through a lot of changes, especially since the pandemic. So my question for you is that over the last year, we went from 5% telemedicine to 86% telemedicine. And what we learned really fast is that we had to adapt to new technology. And it seems that there is new tech and we're being marketed different tech platforms everywhere. How do you organize the people like coming at you to help out, whether it's scaling your practice or improving operations using technology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first thing I'll say is I'm almost never the first person that they interact with. So if I got someone who wants to pitch a new piece of software, a new piece of equipment, I have them go through someone else. So I have somebody else vet that. So we have an office manager here, or for example, in my endoscopy center, we have an endoscopy center manager. And then separate from that, we have a supply person. And they're the ones that get the first round of communication. And we've done a lot of training, we've done a lot of coaching, and they know what kinds of things we want. And so what I want to hear from them then is a report or a, you know, not a formal thing, but, you know, a report of, okay, here's what this technology is, here's what it can do for us, here is the expense, and ask them for their general assessment. You know, this is either, yeah, this is something that could be really valuable, but maybe it's not worth the expense, or nah, this really doesn't do anything extra than what we already do. So that's the first thing, is have someone else be sort of your triage. Kind of like if you go into the ER, you've got a triage nurse before they get back to the ER doc, right? So same kind of a thing. The other thing I'll tell you is that I almost never adopt any new piece of technology first. So I tend to not be an early adopter on things. And so if it's the first iteration of something, I generally don't get it yet. And I almost never am going to get it unless I've talked to someone that I know that has implemented it and that really likes it. So I'll give you an example. About 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when I was down in Florida, Remicade is one of the medications we use for Crohn's disease, for example. And they came out with a whole series of what they call the biosimilars, which are synthetic analogs of those same medications. And they're cheaper, but they were new enough that I wasn't sure if they were going to really work very well. And so my attitude was, well, why would I use something that might work when I have something that does work? And so I wasn't ready to do it. But then a couple of years later, they come back to pitch me again. I talked to some other people and I talked to several friends that they're like, oh yeah, we made the switch last year. 100% of people switched over and everyone's doing fantastic. Well, that's great. That's a great personal testimonial. And then I look and see, okay, look, oh my gosh, it's going to save 85% in cost. That's huge. And I got people that are telling me that it works, that I trust. And so having those testimonials from people that I know and trust is really valuable. So those would be the two things I would suggest.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. I saw your thing about the story brand thing. Yeah. The one-liner concept comes straight out of story brand. They get credit in the guide, right, as you'll see. But yeah, if anybody was interested in marketing stuff, go read Building a Story Brand. That's one of the books on my reading list. It is absolutely a phenomenal book.
I agree. And I actually recommend it. We went the same framework, and I think having the right framework is a great place to start. Dr. Ruan, thank you so much for your question. Dr. Ravi, I'm bringing you on next. So be ready. And you are on, Ravi. Go ahead and unmute yourself. Can you hear us?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Robbie. Hi. Thanks for coming on. Maybe can you give us a little background? Where do you sit in a practice? Are you a physician? Are you a practice manager? And then also let us know what your question is.
So basically, I'm an infectious disease, wound care, and obesity medicine doctor. I'm in Georgia. And I was in Ohio before and moved from there and restarted the whole practice all over again. And
wow.
Ended up having to go with the EMR. I don't know if I'm allowed to take the name of the EMR, but I can take it if you are okay with it.
Yeah, but, I would take it.
Etinanet. And basically, the issues are, I'm still understanding their process and whatever, and they take a percentage of whatever you are doing, then that's fine too, because I agreed for it. But the question just comes down to how, since I'm restarting the whole practice, I am having the staff, my old office manager, I'm paying a little bit extra to help me do this. I used to be a private physician in Ohio and then took over and started the whole process here. And I am in this complex picture where I do infectious disease and I do advanced wound care and I do obesity medicine. So this is like a spectrum disease. And sometimes, like example today, I have this patient who comes with an ankle wound with a Medicaid, and I'm like, I don't have the approval, but I have the patient with the doggy eyes sitting in front of me, and I got to take care of her, which I did, of course. And I'm trying to get the insurance approval, like almost for 3 weeks right now. And the question is, I want to help the patient. That's my problem. You know, like when you said embrace the uncomfortable, that's where I become uncomfortable. Like I have become uncomfortable when I see a Medicaid or a no pay patient. But I say, this is my job. This is what I'm taking up. I have to serve and I take it on. And, you know, I'm not worried about the pay part of it. Yes, I have to be worried. For my business sake, I have to be worried. But how do I work around? Yes, I embrace that uncomfortable aspect. Initially, I say, oh my God, I have to do this. But then I say, no, I'm going to do it because this is what I want to do with myself and deliver that solution. And then, yeah. Of course, the wound is improving. Now, how do I take the solution that you provide, or how do I change in improving the outcomes and the revenue side? And am I doing everything right, or is there anything more that I have to do?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I hear this kind of thing a lot from folks. So the first thing I'll say is, in that specific situation you just said, if you got a patient that came to you and then they can't pay, then I think that if that's me, then that's incumbent on me to take care of the patient at that point. They've done everything that we asked of them. And so I'm just going to have to eat the cost of that. And yeah, that sucks for the business, but that's just the way it is. Now, having said that, I don't think you have to sign up for that on a regular basis. And so what I would propose is that after you take care of that patient that's sitting in front of you that made it through all of your gates, you need to go back and figure out, well, how did this person make it through to this point? How is someone who can't pay us anything for our services making it through to where they actually sat down with me? That shouldn't happen. Now, you can decide what percentage of your business you want to be Medicaid or even pro bono, if you will. And that's certainly up to every individual physician to make that decision. I mean, we do take a certain percentage of those folks, but you can't make that 100% of your business. You'll have no business. So you have to decide what level of, or what percentage of people that are either no pay or minimal pay you're willing to accept. Once you make that decision, then you got to put some boundaries in place and say, okay, how are we going to get people in a way that we know for sure that they can pay? And so before they ever schedule an appointment with you, you need to have their insurance card. You need to have whatever pre-authorization, pre-certifications that you have. Don't even bother scheduling anything until you have that stuff. Because what'll happen is that, you know, their systems, you know, the systems over at the insurance company will be bogged down. You'll be short-staffed. Someone's going to be on vacation. and stuff just gets dropped, right? So set some specific boundaries that prevent you from seeing patients for free unnecessarily. And that's not callous and cruel. It's not reasonable for someone to expect that they shouldn't have to pay you for your services. So if I got, so no one ever goes to a mechanic and says, listen, I need you to fix my car, but I only have $20 and I really need that for food. So I'm afraid I can't pay you, but I'm expecting that you're going to, you know, fix my car for me. That would be kind of ridiculous. So, so set up some of those boundaries. I think those are fair, reasonable. Those are healthy boundaries, but set up some of those gates where people don't actually get scheduled to see you unless they have paid the bills that they are owed, that you are owed already, and that they have been pre-certified, pre-authorized, or whatever kind of requirements and you know hoops the insurance company requires you to jump through before they ever actually sit down with you. And if they make it through those gates and you realize you're not going to get paid, that's on us as the physicians. That's on us as the business owners. We take care of the patient in front of us. Then we got to go fix the business side separately.
Yeah, that was a really great question. Dr. Kamapali, let me allow you to talk, actually. Robbie, are you?
Thank you very much. Basically, that helps. But yeah, hello, I'm back. Hello.
Yes, yeah, we can hear you. Sorry, go ahead.
Basically, that's one.
Oh, Dr. Robbie, I think you're cutting out pretty bad. We can't really hear you. Dr. Lacey, oh, they're coming back in.
So yeah, we're not really getting you there, sir. Maybe we'll give you a second to get that sorted out.
Was going to work with that.
Oh, there you go. What was that? Last thought?
Athenanet, how do you guys work with that?
Yeah.
The EMR system?
Yeah. I think that's more, it's a question I can kind of handle. Dr. Kamapali, so we do work with that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to shoot you a message and get you right away in touch with one of our team that can specifically help you. But I think you asked a very valid question a lot of physicians wonder about, which is how do you manage these things? And, you know, I would not go to an orthopedic surgeon if what my need is let's say infectious disease related. So in the same light, I don't recommend any physician to go to an EMR company when they're trying to absolutely maximize their reimbursement claims and have a strategy around that. So we provide a free benchmark assessment. I'm putting in the link for all the attendees. I'll shoot you an email. I recommend going through this assessment because at least gives you an idea of where your practice is at, how it's doing, and what you can do, whether or not you use Gentem or not. But I'll follow up with you separately and we'll get you, you know, taken care of because I know how overwhelming this could be. My father as a surgeon dealt with it as well. So we'll follow up with you and get that taken care of, okay?
Okay, thank you.
No problem, thank you. All right, we're gonna allow for a few, I think we might have covered all the questions. Let me see if there's anything else. Oh, one more question for you, Dr. Lacey. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'm excited because the spicy ones are usually submitted anonymously. So, okay, so let me just read to make sure this is broken. Okay, the biggest issue is how does one compete in a market where one large insurance company won't put you in their network and they own 60% of the market? That's a great question. Dr. Lacey, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So that's a really tough situation. So one of the things I would suggest is that if that's the case, you're probably not the only person to whom that has happened. And so one of the things that I would suggest is to start calling around to some of the other practices in the area, maybe some of your referring doctors or some of your, you know, if you're a surgeon, you know, let's say one of your surgeon colleagues or something like that, that you trust and say, hey, you know, we're kind of having this issue. Have you guys run into that? Because it's very possible, even likely, I would say that other groups have had the same kind of a problem and just see what their solutions were. The other thing that I think would be really good is to have someone on your team that can do some of this negotiating for you. So if you're not really good at this, if this isn't your, you know, this isn't really your forte, is this is where having someone on your team that has a different skill set than you can be very helpful. So for us, for example, when we've run into that, none of the physicians really deal with insurance companies. We have an office manager, now CFO, that does all that kind of stuff for us. And yeah, we had to negotiate some rough contracts previously. But you know, either you have to be, you have to just be accepting that you're only going to get, you know, 40% of the insurance market share, which is going to significantly limit you. In which case, you got to get more creative in terms of what kinds of things you offer in terms of your revenue streams and things like that, or figure out what other solutions other people have come up with and adopt that. The other thing that is, that would be a good thing to think about is just find out why. You know, you ought to be able to get some kind of reason, and some kind of reason, I would ask for some kind of reasoning in writing. And so maybe it's something that they, you know, who knows, maybe it's something that they looked at something on your credentials or something in your practice that they're like, that popped a red flag, but it's, and it turns out it's something that is completely nonsensical, or it's a misunderstanding. You know, there's lots of really goofy things that can happen that are administrative things. And there's some administrative flunky at the insurance company that says, oh, well, no, they don't meet our criteria. We're not going to accept them. And it never actually makes it to a decision maker's desk. So I wouldn't give up just at the first no. You're going to have to be persistent. So that would be a couple of things that you can do. And then, you know, if it comes, you know, if it comes right down to it, you may have to start getting creative, and just go to some of the other insurance companies. Another thing that you can do is if, you know, if you're in a specialty in a big area where there's other groups that are either, you know, that are not on the insurance company, maybe you can figure out a way to collectively negotiate. You know, everybody negotiates together. I've seen people do that with hospital contracts, for example. So our group, we did that. It was been a long time ago now, but we actually banded together with a local hospital to negotiate collectively with the insurance company. And so having that, and so we offer the benefit to the hospital being able to, you know, provide our services to them. And then the benefit they were able to offer us is that they're a bigger gorilla in the room, right? So they have a little bit more negotiating power. And that turned out to be a very beneficial situation. So maybe you can find a strategic partner that you can ally with that will increase your negotiation power. So those are a few things that you can consider doing.
Fantastic. And it looks like, those are all the questions that we've gotten so far. And I guess the attendee who asked the question, they said that they've done this and, you know, they don't have any solutions. We hired a consultant, did not work, and they won't budge. Well, I'll tell you what, that definitely gave me an idea for the next webinar, which we should probably do soon, which is how to address this issue. But Dr. Lacey, I want to be mindful of your time. We really appreciate your presentation here, which is extremely in-depth and insightful. Again, for those of you who are watching either live or on demand, you can submit your questions to us through email. We're going to have some links in the webinar email that goes out and this recording. Plus, just a little teaser. Dr. Lacey, can you just tell us real quick? I know you have an exciting course coming out. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I want you to mention it because I think it's an important topic for physicians to kind of find a solution to.
Yeah. Sure. So I've got a series of online courses for physicians that are going to be coming out in the next year. We've got a personal finance one coming out probably late this year, a leadership one probably coming out next year. But one that's coming out here first is it's kind of a unique topic. It's called Residency Proof Your Marriage. So I've just seen that it's the medicine, the training in medicine, the career in medicine is just a very dehumanizing, very divisive kind of time for a lot of people. And the divorce rate for physicians is unfortunately high. And if that's something you've had to go through, my heart goes out to you because that's really never fun for anybody. But this course was designed to try to help people strengthen their relationship with their spouse so that you have, you have the strong relationship at home that you do with, and just like you have a strong career at work. So yeah, if you're interested in that, you can email me at editor@scopeofpractice.com. So if, I'm certainly happy to get you in touch with that. But yeah, that's we're really excited about that. And it's just the first of a series of courses that are going to be coming out, just lots more content coming out to help everybody.
Fantastic. Well, again, Dr. Lacey, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening live or listening on demand. We also have a podcast with Dr. Lacey that's going to be releasing soon that goes into some other interesting topics, but we'll put all that and more in the show notes and also the webinar email. So this has been another episode as part of our Private Practice Growth Series webinar. Thank you very much. I'm your host, Omar M. Khatib, the head of growth here at Gentum Health, and we'll see you all next time. Bye for now, and thank you for joining.